This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. It is The Bigger Picture and it's Mira Sivis. So the Pulitzer Prize winning journalist for the Wall Street Journal 2007, Mei Fong, investigated a whole lot of issues. She's done the controversial backstage of the 2008 Beijing Olympics. She's visited the site of the debris after the Sichuan earthquake and disclosed the hidden link between a small town's brand new factory and its climbing cancer rates. Now, Mei Fong's commitment to finding the human story behind major economic events and natural disasters earned her that Pulitzer Prize, you know, International Reporting Award. With her colleagues from the Wall Street Journal. And she joins me all the way from the US. I'm right here in the studio today. Welcome to the show, Mei Fong. How are you today?
I'm good.
Mei Fong, I'm just very upset that you were born in Malaysia and you've left. You've contributed to the brain drain of this country. What led you to move away from this country?
Well, I spent a lot of my time here. I wasn't one of the ones who left very early on. I studied all the way to my STPM at Bukit Bintang Girls School.
Right.
Yeah, I had
school doesn't quite exist anymore, but
no, it doesn't. And you know, I'm still very fluent in Malay. You know, but it just so happened that when I was 18 or so, my father passed away, and I had a sister down in Singapore who suggested I go down there for A levels, mm-hmm. and so I went down to Singapore, and from then on, I won a scholarship by the local, you know, the Straits Times Group, and one of the conditions for us to work for the paper. So I started off as a cup reporter at the new paper, mm-hmm. and you know, from then on, it just seemed like my career took me further and further away from Malaysia.
And you landed up in the U.S.
And I landed up in the U.S.
Right. But you have a special interest in China, Mei Fong. Why is that?
Well, you know, it didn't turn out that way. One of my first tastes of as a foreign correspondent was when I was based out of a new paper working in Singapore, and because it was a small paper, they would sometimes send even the rookie reporters, which I was at the time, to Indonesia and to Malaysia. So I was sent out here to cover, for example, the Anwar trials. Mm-hmm. And then when I was in 1997, now we're on a Hayes topic, right?
Yes.
In 1997. When
Nothing much has changed.
Yes. I was, that was my first foreign assignment. They sent me out to Sumatra, mm-hmm. to cover the forest fires. And that was very exciting.
Yeah.
And I saw all the foreign correspondents out there, you know, from CNN and all, and I wanted to be like them. They seemed so sophisticated. They were flying around the globe, you know, and you know, this was not that long ago, but it was actually a very long time ago. There was no internet then. I remember waiting for a flight to get to Sumatra, and you know, as then the aviation was very bad because the haze was so bad, they closed down all the airports and they weren't flying any flights to Sumatra from Singapore. I went down to the islands, the Ria Islands, to get a flight, and when we got there 2 days later, there was a flight crash. They closed down all the airports. And there was no communications. There was no internet. I didn't know how my stories were playing. And we used satellite phones then, these big, yeah. you know, bricks. And, you know, it wasn't that long ago. And now the haze is back, but things have changed so much mm-hmm. since then. Yeah, right. But I wanted to be a foreign correspondent then.
And you did. You did become one.
But I didn't think it was going to be China. Mm-hmm. I thought it was maybe going to be Indonesia. Admittedly, my Indonesian, my Bahasa is much better than my Chinese. But I ended up in New York doing grad school at the Columbia School of International and Public Affairs. And it just seemed like China was taking off then economically. And so there was a big interest in going there. Mm-hmm. And I just naturally ended up there, I suppose.
How long did you spend in China?
I spent 3 years in Hong Kong and 3 years in Beijing. So all in all, 6 years.
And in that short time, you did quite a lot of interesting work. As a journalist yourself, you had very interesting encounters, for an example, with the Sichuan earthquake. You want to relate some of that experience?
Yeah, the earthquake was actually a point in time where my journalism career took a U-turn, so to speak. What happened was, at the time, right before the earthquake, I was actually in Yunnan trying to get a visa to Burma. There was a cyclone Nargis at that time,
yes.
that happened. And mm-hmm. so at that point, nobody knew what was going on in Burma. They closed off all entry. I was trying to get in and get a visa. It didn't happen. I didn't get one. I was up in the air flying back to Beijing when the earthquake happened. Mm-hmm.
when I landed, a lot of my colleagues were already on their way to Chengdu. This is the nature of journalism. You always go where everybody else is running away from. So I was kind of mad. I was like, oh, no, if I stayed in, you know, Yunnan, I could have hired a car and driven to Chengdu. Now I'm late into the game. So I was a little bit frustrated about that. But as it happened, there was a story that I could do, which I realized. The thing about Sichuan is it's kind of like the Philippines of China, mm-hmm. in that it's a poor place and a lot of guest workers come from Sichuan. So there were a lot of people from Sichuan in Beijing where I was already, and they were very worried about what was going on in Sichuan. So I came up with the idea of saying, what if I followed a group of Sichuan guest workers back home, mm-hmm. and tell the story of the journey itself? So I went to the train station, I looked around, because, you know, foreign correspondents, this is a part of the glamour. You fly in, right? Everybody wanted to get in there really quick.
Yep.
But the story of the people was actually on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
Most guest workers cannot afford to fly.
Yep.
They take the train. So I looked around and I found a group of construction workers. And I said I would follow them. But these were very hardy construction workers. They were like, oh, we'll take the train for 4 days. We don't know. The roads are broken. And we might hike for 3 or 4 days. And I was sort of thinking, oh, no, how am I going to keep up? I actually rang my editor and said, you know, how about we hire a car and drive them back? Can we do that? And she said, no, you have to, you can't alter the story. You have to just follow it, but you can't change the course of it. That's the story. So I knew that was the answer, but I was sort of like, oh, no. So went there, and it was actually it ended up being a 3-day journey. We hiked, we rode motorcycles, we rode boats. They lived in a very remote village. And the outcome was very sad at the time, because what happened was most of them went back home only to find that most of their children were dead. So it was a very sad kind of a story. And only later on did I realize that the other implication was that this was touched upon the book that I'm currently working on, which is the one-child policy. Most Sichuan was actually a pilot test case before the policy was launched. And so most of these people had only one child.
Mm-hmm.
So when they lost that in the earthquake, it was like they lost everything. So even one of my follow-up stories was, even 2 or 3 weeks after the earthquake, people were having reverse sterilizations, reverse operations to reverse that, just so they could have children again. They were desperate. Most people would not think about it, and within a 3 or 4, you know, week period, you're still mourning your lost child. But these people were, you know, TikToking. And so then I started thinking, well, you know, this is a very interesting policy. It's been going on for 30 years. What are some of the implications of that policy? Now, you know, if you only have one child, what does it mean for your labor? You know, the labor that's in the factories, all these people starving. If China's the most populous nation, and so much of that informs its economic growth, right? We think of China, we think of big markets, world's biggest cell phone market, world's biggest internet market. Well, all that goes away after a while when you stop being the world's most populous nation,
mm-hmm.
when you only have one child each.
That's right. So but personally, Meifeng, I mean, did you feel the whole culture behind the one-child policy?
I did. I mean, personally, because I'm the ethnically Chinese. My grandparents are from Guangzhou, so they came out here, and my family is ethnically Chinese, so we hold a lot of, you know, old traditional beliefs. I'm one of 5 daughters. I am the 5th girl. And the reason why I'm the 5th daughter is because my father really wanted a son.
Yeah. Did it happen?
It did not. Okay. So he was very disappointed. I've been told that, you know, he was really, really disappointed. And
how does that make you feel, though?
Well, it made me aware of this was under the other aspects. You know, if I had been born in China, I might perhaps not exist. Mm-hmm. I might have been given away. I mean, as so many of the girls in China are. So it made me want to dig a little deeper into the whole story. I mean, because part of the one-child policy is this thing that we're starting to see now, which is a gender imbalance.
Mm-hmm.
Too many boys, not enough women. And that's particularly happening in the countryside. A couple of years later, I actually visited one of these bachelor villages, small village in the middle of nowhere.
They actually exist?
Oh, yeah. Too many men, not enough women.
Okay.
You know, and so this village had almost no marriageable women of any. So what happened was, one guy met a girl and he married her. And now the thing is, traditionally in Chinese culture, you pay a small bride price. Groom's family pays the bride's family a small bride price. They call it chai li.
Mm-hmm. It's like the dowry in the Indian.
It's kind of a dowry,
but it's the other way around for us.
And used to be very small, but because of the scarcity, women gone up. So now it's worth like maybe 10 years of farming income. You know, girls get in demand. So this created a scam system. So what happened in this particular village was there was a runaway brides. One woman got married to this guy. His family paid her family money. Then everybody else gets a bit jealous. They say, hey, they asked the bride, can you introduce him? You know, do you have a friend you can introduce to my son? She says, I think so. She introduces one bride to one family, another bride to another family. They pay over the money. Within a week, all the women vanish.
Right.
So,
Oh, boy.
Yeah, when I first read about that small, I read a small snippet about it in a local paper, and it seemed like almost a movie. You know, you can see the cinematic, you know, a woman racing across the paddy fields, her wedding veil flying off. And I thought, you know, all these, you know, lonely, dejected men hanging around. And I thought, I've got to go down there and see what's going on.
And so you did.
And so I did. Mm. And one of the funniest comments I got was from this farmer. One of his sons was the one that was duped, and he had more than one child. He had two sons. He had, you know, broken the law because he had sons because he liked sons. And he said to me, you know, I don't know what I'm going to do because I borrowed all this money for my number one son to get married, and now we have to pay it back, and I still have number two son coming up. I wish I had daughters. And that's, you know, that's like such a big flip around, you know.
Yeah. These, you know, to me, it's amazing how these policies come and bite you in the back.
They do. Oh. I mean, the policy was created before there was IVF, before there was scanning. So now, here's the other thing. You know, people are trying to have multiple children avoid getting around it.
Yeah.
There was a case last year, a woman in Guangzhou had 8 children with 2 surrogate mothers because she wanted to get around the one-child policy.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, have them all at one go, so hopefully avoid paying the kind of fines that you need to. You know, nature finds a way, you know, it's like the Jurassic Park movie. Man can try and hold it in, but nature will find a way.
That's right. We're finding out more about Mei Feng and her work as a journalist in China. Mei Feng's actually an expert on China and Asia issues. She's a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist for the Wall Street Journal 2007. When we come back, we'll find out more about that award that you actually won together with your colleagues, as well as more about the one-child policy and what it entails for China going forward. That's coming up next on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon. It is The Bigger Picture and it's Mira Sivasuthi, journalist Mei Feng with me. She's an expert on China and Asia issues. Mei Feng's very much Malaysian, lives in the US for how long have you lived there now?
Actually only the last 4 years.
Oh, that's all?
Yeah.
Okay, all right. I was very hard on you, isn't it? But, you know, Mei Feng's got interesting stories to tell. She's now embarked upon coming out with her own book on the one-child policy in China. And we're finding out a little bit more. If you have a question for her, send us a text message. The number is 016-201-9000 or tweet BFM Radio. You know, Mei Feng, what are some of the human costs of this policy that you foresee going forward?
Well, one of the big problems is the China we see today is not going to be the China we see tomorrow. So the China we see tomorrow is going to have too many men and it's going to have too many old people.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the consequences. And that has big issues going ahead because we're so used to viewing China as the big engine for growth globally, particularly since Europe and the U.S. are slowing down. But that growth is not going to come. If they're going to face these demographic headwinds, old people don't buy iPhones and iPads and things like that. If we only need an example, we look at Japan. For example, Japan, there was a story about how fax machines still continue to sell well in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody uses fax machines that much anymore privately. But in Japan, they do because in Japan, people are old and they don't want to adjust to new technology.
They have an aging population.
They have an aging population, so they like fax machines. So if we translate that to China in the future going ahead, the nation that's the world's fastest growing internet market, cell phone market, car market, what happens when that is a nation where one in every three and one in every fourth person is over the age of 60?
Mm-hmm.
And that also has issues with pensions, right? That's what you need when you get older. You need pensions. If you have so many people needing to draw on the pension, some of these estimates are that China will face serious pension shortfalls by as much as 40% of their GDP. That's serious.
Mm-hmm.
The other issue is the male issue. If you have too many men and not enough women, And this part is kind of speculation because we've never seen anything like what China has with the one-child policy. No other nation in this world has ever had anything in this major
way before. Correct.
You just can't imagine. There's been some speculation by sociologists going ahead that when you have a nation with too many men and not particularly women, this is what, no pun intended, but this is what the demographers call a male bulge. Yeah, so you have too many young men who are angry and dissatisfied. And we see some of that now in the Middle East, mm-hmm. right? You know, in Egypt, Tahrir Square, it's dangerous. You know, in India. This can cause a lot of social unrest when they, you know, demographically, you just can't marry if there are no women, unless, of course, your government loses its, immigration policies, for example. So that might happen. But, you know, who knows going ahead. And the other issue, which is some of this economists are predicting, is when families have sons and not enough daughters, what they do is they start saving. They start saving more so their sons can be more attractive on the marriage market. So when you already have a nation with a very high savings rate and people aren't spending enough, that doesn't make the economy go around.
Yeah.
There have already been stories and reports about villages in China where they look like little churches, you know, with steeples, very high steeples. Why is that so? Every family will build a steeple on top of their existing house to make it look like they have a 3 or 4-story house when they only maybe have 1 or 2 stories. And this is to make themselves look richer than they are so that their sons can marry women. Attract women.
Oh dear.
So it's very bizarre, and that's just another consequence of the policy that we look. And then the other aspect you think about is, what is it like when you have a whole nation full of people who are just singletons, right? They call them little empress, Xiao Huangdi. No siblings to share with. What does it do when you create a whole nation? There have been some studies done. I think that recently, earlier this year, Australian National University did a sort of a study test case. Their conclusion was a nation full of singletons, of single children, tend to be much more risk averse. They're not so entrepreneurial. And you kind of see the logic of that in some way. If you are the only child and your parents tell you you're the only hope for them and you are their sole support mm-hmm. and they don't have that much in the way of pensions, you're not going to maybe do a startup. You know, you're going to get a safe, steady job so that you can support all these people. Because from being the little emperor with 2 parents and 4 adoring grandparents, 30 years come around, they're all old, and you are going to be the little slave taking care of all these people who are getting older, getting sicker, and that's just you.
Is they called the sandwich generation? Except for in this case, it's just going to be one person.
That's just one.
Yeah. To sort of support, the parents, the grandparents, and you're of that working age.
Yeah.
And there's not enough people to spread that.
No. Exactly.
Expenses.
4, 3, 2, 1. Yeah.
That's right. but Mifon, what do you think? How do you think this is going to impact the world?
Well, that's the interesting question going ahead. I mean, to some extent, we see. Economically right now, every time China sneezes, now the world is starting to catch a cold. And we've seen that recently with this slowdown in the commodities market. China is the biggest purchaser now for a lot of commodities. Coal, for example, it's a big, hungry nation, growing very fast. And when there was an economic slowdown, as there has been recently, now we're starting to see layoffs in places in Brazil, in Australia, in the coal mining areas because of China. So you can see there's this long, strain going forward. I remember reading this quote by a friend of mine in Financial Times, which I thought really said it very well. A long time ago in China, they had a huge famine, and nobody knew about it outside because it was closed off. But now, when Chinese people stop buying Louis Vuitton bags and stop buying cars, everybody cares.
Yeah.
So that's kind of what's going ahead. What's going on in the world's second largest economy, which will be the world's largest economy very soon, is going to affect all of us. We don't exactly know how, but the demographic headwinds are troubling because you kind of see where this patterns could go. They may be unexpected, but they are troubling.
Mm-hmm. And what about policymakers? I mean, if you look at the supreme policymaking body of the Communist Party, I mean, it's made up of all men. And do men also dictate these policies that affect hundreds of millions of women?
Well, it's not just in China that happens,
well,
that's shall we
true.
Say.
Well, you have a point there.
Well, you know, traditionally Chinese, you know, are quite, you know, to some extent, they have been more liberated than other nations, right? From communist periods, women worked outside the home. And in Mao's time, they used to have a saying, women hold up half the sky. Well, going ahead, there's been a lot of talk about whether or not this policy should end and when and how. There've already been some changes to it. They've been tweaking it a little bit. For example, in big cities like Shanghai, if you are only single child and your spouse is a single child, you will be allowed to have two children. Mm-hmm. So they've been tweaking it in little ways like this. But there are concerns. You know, I think if you flip the example, in modern cities, Singapore, for example, just very close to us, they had sort of a population, you know, policy a couple of years ago. You know, in the 70s, they encouraged people not to have so many children.
Yeah.
And now they have the other problem, mm-hmm. in that women don't want to have so much. You're a modern woman. You have a job. You know, you have a lot of things to take care of. You can't have more than one or two without it being so expensive and time-consuming. And so that's the same issue that China's going to have in the big cities. You
but
know, Shanghai already has one of the lowest birth rates in the world.
Right. But then, Mei Feng, I mean, one of the reasons why the one-child policy came into play is also because of the population. Mm-hmm. China has a huge population. And you know, we have a question from Chao Pong, who's asking, in on hindsight, what would be the implications if there wasn't the one-child policy? And knowing that Chinese consume and waste more than most countries, you know, just to look at the flip side, if mm-hmm. there wasn't the one-child policy.
What if? Yeah, it's very tempting to play the what-if game, right? So
yeah.
Let's take it 30 years back, which is when the policy came into place. 30 years back, China wasn't the only country or the only nation that was troubled by this issue. At that time, it was actually quite in vogue scientifically to think of the world as a place that was going to be overwhelmed by rising populations. There was a group of academics called the Club of Rome, mm-hmm. that propounded this, you know, what if we don't want to overwhelm the so there were a lot of speculations and projections that by year 2000 the population growth was going to overwhelm the global resources. Well, it hasn't happened. In many ways, people do get more efficient in some ways. That isn't to say, of course, that China didn't have a population overpopulation. They did. They had a big spurt. But here's the thing, right? There were a lot of other policies that were being put forth and discussed at that time. Mm-hmm. And actually, China actually already was slowing down their population. Some demographers argue that China didn't need to go to this huge extent of going one-child policy only. They were already doing policies like have to space your children further apart, marry later. And some demographers argue that this was already slowing down the population growth. Their argument here is that the one-child policy was too extreme. Did you have to go from when you have a headache, do you take, for example, ibuprofen or aspirin or Panadol, mm-hmm. or do you go for brain surgery right away?
That's
you know,
right.
So that is the argument here. And it's kind of hard to tell in hindsight, with the benefit of hindsight, what it could have been. But one of the issues that many modern societies like Taiwan and Singapore are having now in Japan is the other extreme, right? Not enough people. And so I guess the tendency is if you do have these kind of policies in place, there has to be some sort of feedback from the people and a sort of a responsive change. This policy was created 30 years ago before there was IVF, before technology made it so that anybody could scan, even the poorest villages could scan and see the sex of your child and embryo and choose to abort or not. All this was created then, but the policy hasn't been moderated enough to accommodate any of these changes. And so we see some of the problems with that now. Too many men, people try and find ways to get around things like this. And so that is the issue. Yeah. So, you know, did you need one child? Did you need a one-child policy? What if you'd had a two-child policy instead? What if you had two? And what if you spaced it out longer? What if you faced it at, shorter time? You know, could this problems have been averted?
Yep.
Possibly,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Right.
But the whole problem is there was no dialogue, no discussion, not that much tinkering with it.
Yeah, which also comes back to the fact that China doesn't really have a very open media policy, isn't it? They are very closed. And how did you work as a journalist that way?
Oh, well, I worked in Singapore before that. So. And, you know, China is a much bigger place than Singapore. I mean, well, I always had a difficulty in Singapore because Singapore is so small, 3 million, 4 million. Yeah. Everybody seems to know everybody else. I would try and get the most, you know, do a simple story on, you know, a new traffic light started somewhere. And the typical quote would always be, how do you like this? And they'll say, oh, blah, blah, blah. But don't quote me on that. Even for the most innocuous quote, because people are always afraid that somebody would know somebody. And in Singapore, that frequently happened. In China, because it's such a large country, I actually conversely felt that there was a little bit more freedom. And people were much more expressive mm-hmm. about what they really thought. And, you know, that's funny, isn't it? That's a different perspective.
Never heard of that one before. But in terms of dialogue, as you said, there mm-hmm. needs to be more dialogue. Do you even see that happening? I mean, being, you know, ruled by a communist party, do you think that's going to happen?
Well, there is dialogue, but there's dialogue on a social media level, you know, among with the populace, and there's dialogue.
Well, there are a lot of restrictions in social media as well.
Well, people talk a lot, but then the issue is whether that dialogue translated into policy, into legislation. And that's the two things that we don't really see, because the workings of the party are very opaque. It's a lot of reading the tea leaves, as foreigners we used to, you know, do in terms of trying to figure out, well, you know, this happened. Does this mean that this is going to happen? And there was a lot of, shooting in the dark for that one, because we don't really know, you know, the Communist Party and what it thinks and the policies they have. They're not really that open about it. So, you know, that's it. You know, they have to, you know, the key thing here is economic growth, right? That is, and so I think there has to be some response or changes in anything in order to maintain that level of economic growth. The only question here now is that level of economic growth that we're used to seeing from China in the past, for the past 30 years, it's not going to happen in the future. It just isn't possible to maintain double-digit level growth rates at some point.
But officially, would you say the policy is a failure, the one-child policy?
I don't know. I mean, that's what I mean. I'm working on a book. I'm researching it. I haven't come out one way or the other. But it does seem like there's a flip side in thinking now that in the past, I mean, people would say, you know. Undoubtedly, from the human rights perspective, yes, it's very cruel. But from the economic perspective, it was very, very hard to argue against seeing how China was rising so fast, you know. But now that the growth is tapering off, and now China's in the stage where, you know, what we call the fear of the middle income trap.
Yes.
Which happened
to India as well.
Yeah, you're not having, you know, cheap manufacturing now to sustain your growth. You know, you need to go to the next step. Mm-hmm. Can you go to the next step? That is when I think people will start looking at history. Gives you good perspective. You can't not necessarily see how good or not a policy. Now we have 30 years to sort of look back, and I think now is the time to give that better judgment mm-hmm. based on what we can see. We have more data points now.
What sort of impact do you think your book will make? I mean, it's still in the process of, you know, you're in the process of coming up with it.
No, I don't think, you know, I think there, I hope that, you know, people, you know, who are interested in China will read it and think and all. But let's face it, you know, this isn't going to be 50 shades of gray. Well, maybe 50 billion shades of gray if we're going to talk about the aging population. But, you know, I think, you know, I hope, you know, people will enjoy reading my book and people will be interested in it. But I think, you know, the world will go on as before.
Yes, it will. It certainly will. And we'll all have to, you know, deal with the whole aging population. It's China, yes, all over the place, all over the world. We mm-hmm. have an aging population and it's something we need to address. Mifeng, you're a Pulitzer Prize winner journalist for the Wall Street Journal in 2007 with your colleagues. What did that feel like? And when I was reading what the traditional speech by the presenter at the Pulitzer Prize ceremony in New York, you know, he said something like, congratulations, you now know what your obituary will say, Mifeng, Pulitzer Prize winning reporter. Very morbid way of putting things, but how did you feel? I mean, you're a Malaysian born, you know, gone that extra mile and achieved something which most of us haven't.
Well, I'm not going to lie to you. It's obviously a nice thing to have.
Of course, certainly.
But, and I think the thing is, it's harder. I appreciate it more because of where I come from. You know, when we growing up, you know, if I told my parents I wanted to be a journalist, they, you know, that's like saying I want to be a stripper or something. Mm-hmm. We don't really have that tradition of respecting or you know, wanting your child, you know, finance, your accountant, lawyer. Those are all the traditional ones, right?
Piano teacher,
also respectable. But, you know, journalists, I mean, really? So I feel like it's a long way to go. It was a long way to come. And it felt like good justification, you know, for some of the hard work that went into the whole process. I didn't start off saying, well, I want to win a Pulitzer Prize, because it felt like saying I want to go to the moon. It was a long way to go for Kuala Lumpur. But it feels pretty good. But, you know, let's face it, the Pulitzer Prize is not the Nobel Prize. It is not the Oscar Awards. The ceremony is in the afternoon. Nobody wears, fancy gowns. The prize money has not changed, I think, in a long time. I think it's $10,000. It has to say $10,000. So you're not going to get rich on this one. And I remember they gave us, you get a little certificate, mm-hmm. which we didn't even get to keep, because the Wall Street Journal wants to take that certificate and put it on their awards wall. So
of course,
the first thing I did after that was go to the color copiers and pick up a dozen copies so that we could give them all out to all my colleagues and frame it. So, yeah, but it is nice because it gives you an additional confidence that, you know, if you've done this, you can go on. And that's how anybody builds their career. You know, you start off thinking, well, maybe I could maybe do this. And you gain strength when you've achieved something going. And I'd like to think that maybe out there in Malaysia, there's going to be some young kid who's going to say, well, hey, maybe I want to be a reporter. And then the parents, of course, will say, what? And then you'll say, well, you know, hey, she did it. And, you know, she's not starving in a gutter, so maybe I can do it.
She's
too.
My role model, always. But, done the, hard stuff. And, you know, it doesn't come easy, Mei Fong. I think that's something the younger generation needs to understand. That it's all hard work.
No, I'll tell you, it was all very easy.
No, no. Such hard
just sealed into
work.
My lap.
I haven't even gone into, I mean, I'm running out of time, but I'd love to know the story about how, you know, you managed to convince the small town's brand new factory and found the link to cancer rates in China. I think that was very interesting. I think if you go online, you'll be able to read a lot more about Mei Fong. But you're currently on a sabbatical from the Wall Street Journal, Mei Fong, and you've decided to teach at the University of Southern California's Annenberg School. Mm-hmm. Why did that shift come about? I mean, you're leaving journalism at almost like, you know, you're getting somewhere and, mm-hmm. you know, you're taking a back seat at the moment.
Well, let's put it this way. I had the dilemma that many women did, which is, you know, ticked-tock biological clock. My husband and I were married many years trying to have children, but bouncing around the world in foreign correspondent jobs wasn't helping, I guess. And on that trip to Sichuan that I was reporting on, I was actually pregnant at the time. I did not know
it. Oh, dear.
I had a miscarriage after that, and that was like my wake-up call. That was my U-turn. I realized, well, I love what I'm doing, but I can't do this and have a family. Maybe some women can, some women have, many women have. But physically, I was having difficulty doing it, and I just couldn't hold the pieces together, so maybe I needed to step back. You know, so I stepped back. I had in vitro fertilization. I had my twins at the age of 39. And then after that, you know, of course, the thing is, once you have children, you can't just put them in. you have to actually take care of them. And so that was, again, another reason why I couldn't go back to a job which was very, you know, required you to be on your toes, yep. you know, very much of the time. So let's say I'm transitioning to this other step. I'm still writing. I'm still being interested in world affairs, but I'm also trying to be a mother at the same time.
Which is every woman's challenge. Right?
Every woman's challenge. All the women out there listening out there, I hear you.
Yes. I always, if you get a chance, read Sally Sandberg, the CEO of Facebook. She has an interesting book called Lean In.
I know,
and
Lean
I think
In.
Everyone should read it.
Yes.
Every woman should read it at least. Thank you very much for joining me today, Mei Fong, for sharing your story with us. I mean, very inspiring indeed, especially for those of us who actually want to go on and be journalists. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you.
Mei Fong, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist for the Wall Street Journal 2007, an expert on China and Asia issues, joining us on The Bigger Picture this afternoon on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.